Welcome to Southern Court of Appeals on this lovely afternoon. We have one case on the oral submission docket. My name is Dabney Basil. On my left is Justice Brian Walker. On my right is Justice Mike Wallet. Rose, would you call this afternoon's case for us, please, ma'am?
Court will now call D2P Capital LLC, Matthew Riley Rose LLC. May it please the court, Mr. Perry Cockrell will argue for the appellant, and then Patty Law will argue for the appellate.
Good afternoon, justices. May it please the court, this is a lease dispute. Involves whether rent is in default. As the I represent the appellant, and the appellant was the landlord, the appellee is the tenant. It involves whether rent was in default in 3 months, based on an email exchange which the appellee successfully argued was valid, and therefore the appellee was not in default of the lease. The other issue is whether the appellee was entitled to a rent abatement during the term of the lease, in which the lease premises was damaged and the appellee tenant made 10 payments of the full rent during that storm. 5 months into that restoration period, the appellee sent an email that said they had only had access to 45% of the premises, but then continued to make those payments and did so. Because our client did not believe it was a valid agreement, they filed suit, claimed that they are in default for those 3 months, and that triggered a counterclaim for the abatement claim, far as exceeded the amount that was in default. And the case was decided at two orders. The first order was an interlocutory order that found the appellant liable for the rent abatement, which had already been paid.
Counselor, before you move on, just out of curiosity, if your client thought that the agreement was no good, then why did they continue to accept those partial payments? I mean, I guess there's really, I have two questions. And also, what is your position on that? Do you not think that in some ways that ratifies the agreement?
Well, I don't know the answer to that question because I'm limited to the summary judgment record. But I do know that the client controverted and said it was in default in the summary judgment response. But it also mentioned in his affidavit that that agreement has one other aspect to it, in that there was a class action lawsuit over the business interruption proceeds. So if you have an agreement and it's valid, then why would we not be entitled to that?
But your assumption in your reply brief is that the Sixth Amendment constitutes an assignment of those insurance proceeds. It doesn't say that, does it?
Not an assignment. It's an email exchange that references that if they get proceeds from this class action lawsuit, our client would be entitled to.
No, it says, well, you'll get paid first.
We will get you every penny that we get. So that the question, and we think that's a material term.
Okay.
But if it's, since that term requires additional information as to how do you get that, that means that this agreement can't be valid, and I cite the Chief Justice Massey opinion that distinguishes between what's material and what's not material. If the law provides it, then you may have a valid agreement. If there's other information that has to be supplied, like in this case, where's the lawsuit? How do you get the proceeds? For example, it says,
if I may, are you arguing that it's a material term and it also was the only consideration if there was consideration?
To me, that's yes, because both. There's no consideration for reducing the rent.
Is it an absence of consideration or a failure of consideration?
A failure of consideration.
Did you plead that?
I don't believe so, Judge. I don't believe that's pled. But the with regard to the email exchange, I mean, if it's valid and they say that it is, then it seems like we would have this contractual right to something, which is very ambiguous because you can't supply those terms. So it seems to me that agreement.
What's ambiguous about we'll pay you all the proceeds and That's okay.
But where is the lawsuit? Where is the term? The terms are so vacant, you can't figure out what that is.
Why not?
Well, because I believe we're limited to what is in that. I can't say anything more than what's in that email. But I'll also
aren't the material terms of the email that you'll give us a rent abatement and we'll pay what we owe you on the back end?
I think it's if it's, we have a lawsuit against our business interruption insurance.
Right.
It was denied. If we get that, we will get every penny immediately and first.
And I know you're limited what's in the record, but it seems like in the briefing there was some allusion to what I'm about to say, and that is it seems that today you're arguing that your client felt like there was not a good agreement, although they took some partial payments potentially, but that what really happened was your client found out that they had received monies and they hadn't paid those monies to the landlord client. And that's really what got this whole lawsuit started. Do you agree with that?
I think, yeah, I would say so, because in the affidavit there, what it appears to happen is the tenant did not have the money due to COVID, so they entered into a Fifth Amendment. So they knew how to enter into amendments. It had been amended 5 times before, and 4 times by the previous. So they knew how to do it, and my client expected there to be another document. And as I point out, a lot of times, as the Supreme Court says in the Chalker case, emails are conversational in nature. It's very likely that you would have had another amendment that would have had a lot of other terms in there.
Yeah, but this exchange of emails, it's your client set forth a very specific payment proposal and referenced the existing agreement, changing the existing agreement to the new. And the response was, okay, we can do these things that you've suggested. That's not exactly conversational, is it?
Well, he sends back, can you prepare and execute an addendum? Prepare and execute an addendum. That means he expected him to sign something and send it back. And they didn't. And there's also an apology email for not doing that. Now, this court also, subsequently, Capano and Chalko, do look at the history and the relationship between the parties. And that's post-Cabano and Chalker.
But didn't the parties live up to this so-called email agreement after it was entered into?
Well, they made mailed payments. They made payments. But
and
for
you,
the same
and you,
reason,
they and your client accepted them.
They accepted them.
Okay.
Well, they, yes, they're in, except they did not consider that full payment. And that's why they filed
suit.
Well,
when they received it, did they say, well, this isn't full payment, but we're going to take it anyway, or was that after the fact?
I can't answer that, because I don't think it's in the summary judgment record. I know it was accepted. There was a dispute. They filed suit. Now, they being the FLE, also made payments on this rent without any notice, and it was accepted, and they were able to get them back. So, you see
they were able to get them back. I'm not sure.
The judgment. The judge order said we were in breach of the contract on the rent abatement. That's what it was, essentially a refund claim.
But you went ahead and paid them. Happened at this hearing.
No, I'm referring to the abatement. They made the payments during the storm, okay. Knowing that they say they didn't have it even a large part of the percentage and still the premises and still made the payments, never deducted, and they were able to successfully get a judgment ordering them back.
How does that impact the question of whether or not there was performance under the Sixth Amendment?
I don't believe there is a Sixth Amendment, but I'll say that there's
okay,
this
well,
email
let's
exchange,
assume there's, okay.
Which is doesn't. Otherwise, we're overriding 1915 of the lease. It just doesn't affect. It means the parties can then have an email exchange. That works. But here, the client says, can you prepare and execute an addendum? That, to me, falls right in line with Chalker and Cabano. They didn't prove that this was the final agreement. It proves it's conversational in nature. It also shows things might change, that they might change your mind in this particular case. The tenant successfully did a Fifth Amendment and got their rent reduced, claimed they didn't have the money. Then they got an additional 3 months off. And then all of a sudden, they received almost over $400,000 in proceeds under their insurance claim, and another $37,000 for business interruption, which is what they've sued us for. In other words, they've received under their insurance claim an amount which they're getting a judgment for, it seems. Now, I know we can't rely, we are not saying the collateral source rule and all that, but you see what's happened here. And we were not able to get access to that insurance file, not because we're a beneficiary, RNS, but because it would have verified the damage claim.
Wasn't the motion to compel filed after discovery closed?
I don't believe so, Judge, because I think, because I think discovery closed in October. I don't know the answer to that question. But the judge acted on it and entered an order
denying it.
But I think 5 and 6, I do think that discovery request is overbroad. I don't think it was totally overbroad, because 2 of them go straight to the damage claim, which should have been in those affidavits. And our client should have been able to cross-examine this this witness on this. I haven't actually gotten to the affidavit that they relied on in the interlocutory judgment, and the final is substantially defective because it doesn't have the documentation to prove the link between the facts and the conclusions. How do you know what 10% is, 70%, 30%, and how is it they're all zero magically changed every month? And they're also inconsistent with the pleadings, and they're inconsistent with their affidavit. Now, they did cure that in the final amended claim. They cured the pleading to conform to her, the 2 affidavits, and cured that pleading-wise. But I do think that the fact that it's contradictory is sufficient, because you would cross-examine a witness on that. Show me the documentation to prove that this area was damaged. And also, why is the appellee the witness? Where's the contractor? Where are the photographs? Where's the insurance? Where's the insurance adjuster with photographs showing the premises? Explain to me why you couldn't use this premises. There's just nothing. There's none of that. And so if it's true that that affidavit's defective, that means that first summary judgment order is not valid. And the whole case, if the first summary judgment order is not valid, the rest of the case can't be valid, because you can't recover legal fees and damages if you haven't established liability. Also, I want to point out that on the that they there's proof that there was a storm, but there's no proof that they couldn't use the business premises as a result of the storm. So I don't believe they've actually proved damages in this case at all. They may be able to if they can just produce some documents and let us cross-examine their witness. I'm running out of time, but there was a trial date of December 19. The counsel filed a jury demand. I know there's a waiver in the contract, but there was a motion to quash that jury demand, and it was never heard. But nevertheless, there was a hearing on the 15th. But then there was a trial on the 19th, non-jury. But they set this motion to enter final judgment 7 days before that. I wasn't sure what that was. I didn't think it was a summary judgment, but they say it is now on appeal. And so I did file a controverting declaration of legal fees 7 days before, because I noticed they had a reply that said they call it an SJM motion. So now I realized what they were doing. They were trying to get a second summary judgment heard before the final trial. And they did, and they successfully recovered damages. Now, I couldn't tell what this was. It seemed to me like it was a trial. So I subpoenaed the witness, who's here, asked to call her to testify, but was denied the ability to do that, and I could not cross-examine their attorney. I also filed a controverting affidavit. They also tendered unredacted legal fees in a binder like this to the judge and proved up their legal fees at that hearing. I've never seen a copy, and it wasn't brought up on appeal because it's never marked. So I think that's error. My client could not be there. He's a New York entity. They objected to the trial date. They could not be there. And I think because this witness cries out to be cross-examined on this damage claim, and the fact that they've already recovered $37,000, this case cries out for cross-examination of this particular witness. And has the court reverse the first order and the second order and send it back so we can have a full trial on the merits of this case, which I don't. So I believe the error was harmful. It should be reversible. I did not agree to that trial date. If it's a summary judgment is a trial. The trial can only be on the trial date, and the trial date cannot be changed without the agreement of the opposing counsel. And I didn't agree to that, but nevertheless was put to trial on that day. So for those reasons, I ask the court reverse both orders and also order the discovery of those two requests for production.
You didn't raise, did you raise error from the denial of the motion to compel?
It's in the third, it's issue number two. Sub-issue is where the trial court, when it denied the motion to compel. Issue two. I'm sorry, Judge. Thank you, Judge. Just.
May it please the court. Good afternoon. Let me start at the very end. The answer to your question, Judge, I do think they mentioned the denial of the discovery in their brief, as he just pointed out, but there's no briefing on it. It's a sentence in the brief, but there's no argument, there's no authority, there's certainly no explanation of how the judge abused its discretion, which is a discretionary standard with regard to that discovery.
Maybe you could answer a question for me.
I'll try.
Where in the rule book do I find a motion for entry of final judgment?
You don't.
And at the hearing, the lawyer representing your client made it clear that this was a hearing on a motion and it was non-evidentiary, but then she asked to attach evidence at the hearing, right?
Not exactly.
Well, that was the check, which she then asked the court, which wasn't part of whatever this thing was that she filed that was set for hearing, right?
I disagree with that. It was in the record, a couple of different places.
No, I'm not talking about in the record, but was it part of the? It wasn't part of the motion that was being heard, was it?
Correct, in the sense that the voluntary payment of the amount that had been in dispute was made after we filed the motion. That's
right.
Correct.
Okay, so that, and there was no motion for leave to file a supplemental to have that heard, correct?
Well, when you say heard, I mean, there was no dispute about whether or not they had paid.
Okay, if we start out with the fact that there is no rule which authorizes a motion for entry of final judgment, so now we're off into Never Never Land about what type of hearing this was, aren't we?
Not Never Never Land. That's why we have cases. Let me respond two ways, see if I can get there. First of all, and we've cited the cases in our brief, very often lawyers misname pleadings and filings. We have a rule that the courts say you look to the substance of the motion, not the title. If you look at the substance of our motion for entry of final judgment, it very clearly was asking for summary disposition of the only two final remaining issues, which were our damages.
Which is where I'm going, is at a summary judgment hearing, you don't offer evidence, do you?
Correct.
Okay, and that's what she did, was she offered this check at that hearing, which was labeled one thing, but now is being treated like a summary judgment, right?
It wasn't offered into evidence. There was no evidence offered or admitted by the trial judge. Let me get back to that point. In a summary judgment hearing,
it was attached to the record.
It was in the record. It was in the pleadings. If you look at their supplemental.
And I'm not disputing that it's not in the clerk's file somewhere. Okay.
Yeah, and when you if you read the transcript of the hearing,
I have.
I have no doubt. The check was discussed. I mean, first of all, that benefits them. We were willing to acknowledge that they had paid it. So we weren't asking for a judgment you know, we weren't trying to get double recovery.
I'm just trying to get at the fact that there were things that were done that would you would not expect to find in a summary judgment hearing on a hearing on a motion for summary judgment.
Well, the only two things are the check you've mentioned and the attorney's fees. The attorney's fees, first of all, there's no indication that the trial judge actually even ever reviewed the unredacted versions of the attorney's fees, which we had already submitted the redacted version.
Well, she just said she was going to redact.
She entered the judgment within a few hours after the hearing ended, but they wouldn't have been entitled to the unredacted fees anyway.
Well, what authority do you have that you can submit secret evidence to the court that you don't submit show to the other side?
The rules of evidence allow protection of privileged information.
For purposes of the court deciding whether it's privileged, not to prove a matter which is in dispute, correct? In other words, you can tender documents to the court for the purpose of determining whether or not they are in fact privileged, but you can't submit redacted documents to the fact finder unless there has been determined to be a privilege and they're not entitled to see it, correct?
Sure. Okay. Sure, but the judge was not acting as a fact finder because this was not an evidentiary hearing. Now,
if it's prior to this hearing, the question was whether or not, and if so, how much attorney's fees you were entitled to. So there was a fact to be determined, correct?
Correct, and we asked for summary disposition on it through affidavits, yes.
And so the court is acting in the role of determining a fact. Whether the question if it's disputed or not disputed, correct? All right, go ahead.
Well, and let me stay on that point for a minute, because the attorney's fees, I will acknowledge that if this court believes that they timely controverted the reasonableness of our attorney's fees, I would concede that that's a fact issue that should be remanded. If the court is inclined to do that, I would ask that the court very clearly limit the remand to just that issue. And it's kind of a don't throw me in that briar patch position it puts me in, because on remand, we will get to present the same testimony that we've already presented, but in a different format if they insist on a bench trial on that. Of course, they've waived a jury trial on the lease. But we will ask for additional fees, the fees we've incurred in this appeal. We will ask for conditional fees if there's a subsequent appeal, which we had not done the first time. So, you know, frankly, I wouldn't mind a remand on the fees because they're going to be bigger next time. But let me shift back, because I do want to respond to a few things that counsel mentioned. And I want to ensure on the substantive issues, the breach of contract claims, I want to make sure we distinguish between two different issues. The first is the landlord's suit claiming that my client underpaid the rent for 3 months, December of 2020 through February 2021. And that's the what I'll call the rent deferral, the reduction and deferral claim. And then the second issue is our counterclaim for rent abatement that started in February of 2021 when the winter storm hit, and goes through October of 2021. And that's required by the lease. Summary judgment was proper, we contend, dismissing the landlord's claim, that first issue, for the alleged underpaid rent, because we had the email agreement, the November 2020 email agreement. And honestly, I thought the big issue for the court, and perhaps why you set this case for oral argument, was going to be an interesting issue about whether the email correspondence was a signed written agreement, but that's apparently no longer in dispute because the landlord has said in his brief that
it's a non-issue.
I'm sorry?
I think he says it's a non-issue in his reply.
Yeah, he says it is an electronic signature.
But I do want to ask this question. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I know you distinguish the one case, the primary case that appellant cites on the purported Sixth Amendment.
Yep.
But one thing that I did find interesting, and I was curious what your response will be, is, you know, the point of the case, whether it's distinguishable or not, is that his point is, is that you have to, if you actually in the email say there's going to be a final written agreement, then your argument basically doesn't work. What do you say to this idea that the language there is, you're saying that there's a final agreement, that the terms are there, and of course, then there's also the other issue of the fact that it was in somewhat ratified because there was acceptance of payments. But let's forget about the acceptance of payments and just look at the agreement itself. You know, there definitely is language that says, you know, please reduce this to writing. Please put this in writing. And of course, their argument is, because of that, you know, this was an agreement to agree. It wasn't a final agreement. And you know, what's your thoughts on that?
I have lots of thoughts on that. The question is, and it's a legal determination, does this have all the material terms? How much? It's spelled out, and the landlord in the response email reiterates how much. 13 in December, 15 in January, 13 in February. So how much? How long? 3 months. And what are the terms of the repayment? So the rent is deferred or reduced for 3 months and deferred on a repayment schedule. And the landlord says, as long as you can repay the additional differences the same way we agreed on before. So both parties have referenced the previous agreement, which was the Fifth Amendment, which is undisputed. Though it was disputed at trial, they no longer try to set that aside on appeal. So they reference the terms of the Fifth Amendment. We've got all the material terms. How much, how long, and what are the repayment terms? The specific question you asked about, after he says, we have a deal, then he says, can you prepare and execute an addendum? There's no conditional language. We have a deal as long as we can execute a signed agreement, which makes it very different from the Chalker case, the Copano, all of the cases that hold otherwise. Chalker is very different. It was a hundreds of millions of dollars in dispute, multiple parties, multiple agreements that were intertwined that very clearly said the parties will not have an agreement unless and until a signed written agreement is fully executed, dealing with all of the multiple different issues in that very complicated transaction. This is very different. How much? How long? What are the repayment terms? That's all we needed. Council mentioned that there might be a written addendum that contained all kinds of other details. What other details? There aren't any others to be discussed or negotiated.
It's kind of implicit in his briefing, although he doesn't necessarily cite authority for it, that if you have an amendment, there has to be new consideration. Do you agree that is the law? If in order to amend an existing contract, does there have to be new consideration? Because you are calling it the Sixth Amendment.
Well, there has to be consideration for a contract in general. Two answers. Number one, which I think is the dispositive one, is he acknowledges they didn't plead failure of consideration or lack of consideration. Number two, not only did they not plead it, but they never raised it in response to our motion for summary judgment. I even did a word search right before here. There's no mention of the defense of lack of consideration or failure of consideration. So I think that's off the table just on that basis alone. But, think about the position these parties are in. If the tenant doesn't get a break, you know, they might go bankrupt. And so the landlord has incentive to try to work with the tenant to keep a good tenant there. I mean, I'd say that's consideration enough right there. Both parties referenced the Fifth Amendment, which recites consideration. I think it has the standard, you know, $10 in consideration of whatever. So I'm not sure if it's if separate consideration is required. I think it's there, but certainly they didn't raise it. And let me move to the rent abatement claim, if I may, briefly. That is our claim, unless the court has any more questions on the November 2020 email, which extended the Fifth Amendment for three more months.
Yeah, I do. Okay. I mean, he basically says that this idea that there was ratifications not anywhere in the record, or at least in the summary judgment evidence. Is that not true? Is that not true?
It's first of all, it was undisputed. I mean, they've never said we didn't accept it. And I think, let me see if this.
I mean, it seems from the briefing that it was just accepted that that was the case, that there had been payments made, reduced payments, and those payments had been accepted. But
well, there's somewhere in the record that says the third payment was a little more than was referenced in the agreement.
That's right. Right. It was even more than what was in the agreed in the email.
Yeah, and you know, keep in mind this was a reduction and a deferral, so my client was still obligated to pay the balance, and the agreement was to pay it out over 72 months. But, you know, we were going to pay what we could, and we ended up having a better month that last month than we thought we would, and so we added $2,000 because we knew we were going to have to pay it back eventually. So we actually increased the third month. In the record, I think this is Exhibit 5 to Ms. Sherman's affidavit, Clerk's Record 96, I believe. It's actually a statement of billing from the landlord to my client, and it demonstrates the amounts that were paid. And so you have payment information in there, and I think the record does clarify that when we made that deal in November of 2020, December we made the payment. No complaint. January, we made the payment, no complaint. February, we made the payment, no complaint. There is not any indication of any dispute in the summary judgment record. Nothing that they said that, you know, challenged our payments until about 7 or 8 months later. I think it was in July of 2021. When there was a kerfluffle and emails back and forth about that. So I think the record does establish that they accepted the rents, the reduced payments. And even after March, they began accepting our repayments, because once those 3 months were over, we started adding on because we owed the deferred amount. So we added on a little bit, and they accepted those amounts as well. So very quickly, I don't have much time on the rent abatement issue. They admit that we are entitled to abate the rent under the terms of the lease based on a casualty. They admit that Winter Storm Uri was a casualty. They acknowledge all that. So really the only question is the sufficiency of our proof of damages. And number one, I would say that the voluntary payment that we've discussed, check, mooted any dispute that existed about the amount of damages because they voluntarily paid it. And I do want to get.
Doesn't that get us outside the record of your motion for entry of final judgment?
It does not, and here's why, because if you consider the substance of the motion, and let's just assume for a moment that the court treated it as a motion for summary judgment, which we were asking for summary adjudication of the only final two issues.
Well, except the court entered findings of fact. And if the court entered findings of fact, you can't have that from a summary judgment, can you?
We objected to it on that exact basis. And they insisted on it, and so the court entered.
What the court thought it was doing at this point seems to be ambiguous, doesn't it?
No, I think the court was
pacifying both sides.
Yes, probably. They kept asking for it, filing their you haven't filed them. Please file them. So they finally did. But back to the check for a minute. I think this is important in a summary judgment proceeding. The court has to consider not only the motion, the response, but the pleadings on file. If you look at clerk's record at 767, that's their first supplemental petition, and it was filed before the hearing. It was filed on December 2nd of 2022. The hearing was on the 15th. And in their own petition, They state, on November 30th, 2022, plaintiff mailed defendant the sum of $89,827.61, which is the amount that defendant, my client, claims is owed for rent abatement. And that tender was not conditional. In the pleading, they try to, after the fact, make it conditional, but the tender itself was not conditional.
Well, we really don't. I mean, all we have is the check. I mean, we don't really know what, if there are any documents associated with the tender. I mean, I certainly agree with you with respect to what they pled, but I mean, there are no conditions on the check. But we don't know whether there were any accompanying documents.
If there were conditions on the check, I think we can be assured that they would have brought that to the attention of the court. There were no conditions, and on the check it's written rent abatement.
Oh, no, I agree. On the face of the check, they're not.
I am running out of time. I haven't talked about everything I wanted to talk about, but if there are any further questions, I'd be happy to answer. All right. Thank you.
I would like to respond. There was no voluntary payment of the amount. It was tendered to mitigate the possibility that the landlord would be in default of the lease. It's based on two Missouri cases, which I researched.
Well, how do we know that?
Because at the time of trial, they did try to say it was a voluntary payment, and I argued that it was not. And the pleadings also said.
But at the time it was tendered, how do we know whether it was for one purpose or another? Not when you argued it at the hearing.
Well, that evidence, as far as I'm concerned, that's not before the court, and it was objected to at the hearing. But the pleading that was filed was that this was a conditional tender, and if you're not able to prove damages, then that money must be returned. And it's based on the same argument that they have. They claim that their payment of the rent, full, while they should have abated it, they get that back, and it's not a voluntary payment. And that under the other cases where you have a rent abatement issue, the reason you can do that, tenants can do that and get it back, is because you don't want to run into a situation of it being in default and the lease being forfeited. So this is a mechanism to prevent that from happening. It was also a mechanism to try to mitigate the legal fee claim because it was a breach of contract claim and a declaratory judgment claim as to whether they are entitled to the rent abatement claim. So I don't believe that check is before the court. It was offered at what they now believe was a summary judgment hearing. There's nothing before the court. It wasn't intended to be voluntary, but an attempt to prevent the landlord from being in default of the lease. They also requested additional findings of fact and conclusions of law after judgment. They probably for the same reason, because there was, and the judge did rely on the unredacted legal fee, which was tendered in camera, and the judge later did rule. As far as the responsive on the briefing, the request for production 5 and 6 is on page 43 and 44 of my brief. I think I've responded to their arguments, unless the court have any other questions of me. That. So I would ask the court reverse both of these judgments because justice was not done here. This witness needs to be cross-examined. There needs to be a full airing of the file of their damages. And under Rule 1006, that affidavit was essentially a summary, and there was no substantive documentation. It reminds me of a Justice Holman case where I can get the court the citation, but I do know there's a substantive affidavit case where the person stated that they owed money under a note, but they didn't attach the note. That's a substantive defect, a conclusory defect, because you can't link the facts to the conclusion. Here you have an affidavit that says 20, 30, 40, 70, 90%, but you have no documentation to prove that. That's a substantive defect. It didn't require any objection whatsoever. For an interest of justice, has the court reverse it based on those substantive defects? It never has to get to all the. There's so much issue error in this case. It may never have to get there. If that first summary judgment order is a substantive defective affidavit, the whole case. There is no case. So I ask the court to remand the entire case.
Thank you all. We appreciate your arguments. Court will be in recess.